We'll hear arguments first this morning in McDaniel against Sanchez. Mr. Hall, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This is a case which presents the question of whether Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is 42 U.S.C. 1973 C, requires the preclearance of a county reapportionment plan which was prepared after a trial at the court's direction after a previous plan had been invalidated and after an evidentiary hearing on the use of the proposed plan. And when the plan that was newly presented was declared by the trial court to be one which should be used for the 1980 elections. The original lawsuit was brought alleging an existing districting plan for the four commissioners' precincts of Clayburgh County to be unconstitutional, first because the existing plan diluted the vote of the Mexican-American residents of the county, and secondly, because it violated the one-man, one-vote principle of the Constitution. The trial of the case was devoted primarily to the first question, that is, whether the existing plan diluted the voting strength of Mexican-American residents. At the conclusion of the trial court held that there had been no dilution of Mexican-American voting strength, but that there was a violation of the one-man, one-vote principle, and ordered that the county prepare a new plan and submit it to the court for consideration. The trial court set a hearing date on the new plan. The parties appeared at that time, and incidentally, this was a class action brought by Mexican-American residents of Clayburgh County. At the evidentiary hearing on the plan, the trial court heard evidence as to the statistical results and also heard questions with respect to the effect of the new plan on the voting strength of Mexican Americans, how Mexican American residents and voters had been affected by the particular plan that was presented. The plan was actually prepared by a professor from Texas A&I University whose sole objective was to achieve an equality in number between the four precincts. He was instructed, however, on one occasion that the county would prefer that a boundary line be withdrawn to include the courthouse in Commissioner's Precinct Number 1. He was also asked to try to maintain the integrity of existing voting or election precincts rather than divide them up. He accomplished all this, although he did have to divide or split a number of voting precincts. And as we have pointed out in our brief, this is an action which could only be taken by the Commissioner's Court in July or August of a given year. It was not done in the Texas courts. It was not done in that time period, and the Texas courts have held that a commissioner's court itself is absolutely precluded from making a division of commissioner's precincts other than at the stated time, and that is...
Your opposition disagrees with that.
I know they do, Your Honor, but I disagree with my opposition because I think that the case of Wilson versus Weller makes it very clear, both in its holding and its distinguishing of another Texas Supreme Court case, that where, in fact, election precincts, and we're not talking about commissioner's precincts at this point, we're talking about election precincts. When election precincts are divided or the boundaries are redrawn, it can only be done in July or August and at no other time. In any event, it is a factor in this lawsuit simply because of this court's holding in East Carroll Parish versus Marshall, in which the fact that a Louisiana police jury had no authority to reapportion itself pursuant to an enabling statute which had been questioned by the Attorney General, was suggested to be dispositive of the question whether the particular plan was a court-ordered plan or was a legislative plan. In any event, the trial court did review the plan, and in his order stated that he had considered the plaintiff's objections to the plan as well, and the plaintiff did come forward with evidence challenging the proposed plan on the basis that it did dilute Mexican-American voting strength. The court concluded that the plan was acceptable and ordered that it should be used in 1980.
Did the district court in any way alter the plan as proposed?
No, Your Honor, the district court did not. And following his approval of the plan, there followed a series of procedural steps which resulted in the Fifth Circuit's summary determination that the plan could not be used and should be submitted to the Attorney General or to the District Court in the District of Columbia for preclearance under the Voting Rights Act before it could be put into effect. And, of course, that raises the question presented here, whether a plan conceived as this one was in the course of litigation which had been long since commenced was required to be submitted for Section 5 preclearance, or whether the district court could order such a plan into effect without preclearance.
Did you argue to the Fifth Circuit that the commissioner's court didn't have power to reapportion itself in accordance with this plan?
We did in a motion for rehearing, Your Honor. The truth of the matter is that the question was presented to the Fifth Circuit in a series of briefs that were directed toward a summary reversal of the district court's order.
Well, because the per curiam of the Court of Appeals says, by submitting a proposed reapportionment plan to the district court, the Cleburne County Commissioner's Court complied with and fulfilled its legislative responsibility.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the legislative responsibility to which the Fifth Circuit was speaking was the one which this court has addressed so many times, and that is simply the preparation of a plan or the submission of a plan at the direction of the trial court, rather than the preparation of that plan by the trial court itself. I think that's the fulfillment of legislative duty which is suggested.
Well, that isn't what this language quite says.
I'm sorry?
That isn't quite what this language says. You're saying that all you're saying is that a party to the lawsuit was asked to submit a plan, and it did. The Court of Appeals says it did it legislatively.
Well, Your Honor, I can only suppose what the Fifth Circuit was speaking to there, but I think that all the Fifth Circuit was saying was that this was not a plan which was a court-ordered plan. It was not a plan which was prepared judicially. It was prepared legislatively in the sense that the trial court told the county, one of the parties, to go out, prepare, and return with a plan, and the county did return with a plan, and in that sense it was a legislative plan. In that sense only, it was not a plan that
would would you make the same argument if the court had simply issued a declaratory judgment invalidating the old plan and giving the commissioner's court a certain time to come up with a new ordinance or whatever you what is it, do you call it an ordinance or
It would be an order of the commissioner's court.
An order, yeah. If that's all the court had done, we'll give you time, like courts usually do, to reapportion yourself.
In truth, Your Honor, that is what is done, with the exception that the trial court did not tell the commissioner's court to go reapportion itself. And
It said come up with a... Submit a new plan, that's what
it said. Submit a new plan to the court, not go out and prepare one and adopt it and follow such procedures as might be appropriate if you were not in the middle of a suit challenging the constitutionality of the existing plan.
Well, are you, is it true that in order to comply with the court's view of what was wrong with the old plan, that the commissioner's court would not have the power, under your view of their power, to reapportion themselves constitutionally? In
no.
That they wouldn't have the power at this time to split precincts? And
no, Your Honor. The commissioner's court would have had the power to reapportion itself into four commissioner's precincts. The Texas Constitution says that it may do so from time to time as it deems appropriate. So there's no question about its power to do that.
So it could have complied with the constitutional requirements on its own.
It could have complied with that. The question is whether it could have achieved a satisfactory one-man, one-vote result without dividing election precincts.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. That's what I'm getting at. Would it have had the power to bring itself into compliance with the one-man, one-vote requirement?
Well, truthfully, that question was not litigated, and I know it is raised by the respondents, Your Honor, but the answer is it would not have had the power to do it in the abstract. If there had been no lawsuit, the commissioner's court would not have had the power under Texas law to redraw its commissioner precinct lines if, in order to do that, it had to split some existing election precinct lines. You see, a commissioner's precinct might be made up of six or eight election precincts, which are subdivisions within the commissioner's precinct. And what I understand the state statute to prohibit is the dividing or splitting of one of those subdivisions, one of those election precincts, at any time other than in July or August.
So Commissioner's Court had responded to the court by saying, in order to satisfy you, we would have to exceed our powers. And we just can't, we just are forbidden to propose a plan.
If the
court would have had to draw its own plan, I suppose. And that clearly wouldn't have been subject to clearance.
That would be true. If the county had come back with any excuse, which amounted to a refusal to do it.
Or a claim of legal inability.
That's true. If it said it was unable to do it, it wasn't physically possible, as in this case it could have come back and said it's too late. We're almost to the 1980 election.
Well, you in essence claim that they were forbidden under state law to give a legislative response to the court's request, which is a perfectly legitimate argument.
It's a legitimate argument, Your Honor, but in all candor, that's not really what I'm saying, because I understand you to be asking me whether it would have been physically possible to come up with some other plan which would have achieved the one-man, one-vote result that was desired without splitting any of these sub-precincts, these election
precincts.
You
think it wasn't?
Sir?
You don't think it was possible?
I don't know whether it was or not. I know that the respondents...
But if it was impossible, the commissioner's court wouldn't have had the power to achieve it.
That's true. That's
well,
correct.
Well, is what you're saying that... Had these original plaintiffs simply come to the commissioner's court and said, we don't think the present voting lines conform to the one-man, one-vote rule, we want you to change them, they would not have had the authority under Texas law to change them, and the plaintiffs would have had to go into federal court to get the change.
No, Your Honor, that's not the case. The commissioner's court would have had the authority to change the commissioner's precinct lines, but not if, in order to achieve one man, one vote balance, they had also had to split or divide some of these voting precincts. If in order to get the right number of people in each of the four commissioner's precincts, it had been necessary for the commissioner's court to break up an existing voting precinct, to say, okay, part of you who voted in voting precinct 21 are now going to be in a different precinct. If they'd had to do that, they would have been without authority to do it under the Texas decisions. But if they had not been required to vote to change voting precincts, to alter the boundaries of those, then it would have been within their power to make the change. In any event, the Fifth Circuit concluded that the plan which had been submitted to the trial court and which had been approved by the trial court could not be used because it had not been pre-cleared under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and directed that the trial court and held that the trial court should not have considered the constitutionality of the new plan before it had been pre-cleared, remanded the case. A petition for certiorari was filed, and that brings us to this moment.
Before you get into your argument, may I ask a question about the legislative authority? Assuming it was necessary to break up the voting precincts in order to satisfy the one-man, one-vote requirement, would some other legislative body have had the authority to do that?
No, Your Honor. I don't know whether the question has arisen. The only authority I'm going on is Article 2.041 of the Texas statutes, which simply provides that election voting precincts may not be altered by the Commissioner's Court other than July or August. And there is no other authority in Texas, of which I'm aware, that would have the power to alter election precincts other than in July or August.
Well, then, if there's that restriction on breaking up election precincts, and if that would prevent a one-person, one-vote satisfactory response, would it not necessarily follow that that restriction was invalid as a matter of federal law?
I haven't had the question, Your Honor, and I don't know whether it would be or not. I don't really see why that's not a reasonable requirement.
But it's the requirement that would make it impossible to comply with the Equal Protection Clause if it was faithfully followed.
No, not really, because in any July or August, the Commissioner's Court would have the authority to do that. And the problem simply is one of timing with respect to an upcoming election. The legislature in Texas has simply said, we don't want the Commissioner's Court doing a lot of changing of voting precincts any closer to an upcoming election than July or August. And I think that's a reasonable provision by the state legislature.
But why July or August? Why not any time prior to September 1? What if they do it in May or June?
I suspect, Your Honor, that I don't know why the particular time. I suspect that almost any change could run afoul of the primary and the general election problems that we have in Texas. Generally speaking, primary elections are held in May and the general election in November, and I don't suppose that a change even in July or August in an election year would alter the voting pattern or the place of vote between the date of the primary and of the general election. So I can't answer your question. I don't know why that particular restriction. I don't know. It's not been challenged that I'm aware of on constitutional grounds.
But didn't the primary used to be held in July?
Your Honor, I do not know. For as long as I can recall, it has been held in May, and the court may be correct about that.
I'm not sure.
All right, sir. Well, in any event, the decision of the Fifth Circuit brings us here, and we have a number of reasons for believing that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, as it relates to preclearance, should not be applicable in a case which is already in a federal district court and already subject to constitutional scrutiny. The first reason for this is that as we view the Voting Rights Act, it assumes the existence and the continuation of an existing plan. Both the legislative history and the decisions of this court have referred to the effect of the plan or of the Voting Rights Act in Section 5 as in effect freezing into use and existence an existing plan. And if that were the case, there would be no problem or hardship so far as the election process in the county is concerned, because it would, as it went through the machinery prescribed by the Voting Rights Act, have an existing plan that could be used during the time required for that procedure. But that is not the case where the catalyst for the presentation of a new plan is an order of a federal court striking down the old plan. There is no plan then to be frozen into effect, and there is no plan prepared or participated in by the local political subdivision which can be utilized during the interim. We also think that the language of the Voting Rights Act, which speaks to changes in procedure which a subdivision, a political subdivision, quote, enacts or seeks to administer, unquote, is not simply fortuitous language. We think that the legislature meant what it said, that it was speaking of changes that were voluntarily undertaken by a political subdivision, that is, the political subdivision enacted or sought to administer a particular plan which was different from the one that had existed before and which had been frozen into effect. This is not a case in which the Commissioner's Court enacted or sought to administer a new plan. It did neither. It was told by the trial court it could not use its old plan and that it should submit a new plan. So for that reason also, we think the Voting Rights Act does not apply in a case involving these circumstances. Third, the Voting Rights Act and the decisions of this court speak to the purpose of ensuring that there is a federal presence in the formulation of any plan which is different from the one which had been frozen into effect by the Voting Rights Act. And we have a federal presence in this case, very much so. We had the most intense federal presence that you could imagine in the discarding of the old plan and the formulation of the new plan. We had a federal district judge in Corpus Christi, Texas, one county over from Clayburgh County, who was aware of all of the facts. He had already listened in detail to the plaintiff's class action challenge of the existing plan. He knew intimately what the circumstances and background were. And there was no better forum anywhere to consider the changes which were proposed than the local federal district court. So that objective of the Voting Rights Act, we think, has been squarely met in the case of a plan which is presented following the striking down of an existing plan by a federal district court.
If that's the objective, I suppose the other side of that coin is that the federal presence of which you speak is a specific federal presence, namely the Attorney General or the District Court of the District of Columbia.
Well, that I'm sure is the argument in support of the applicability of the Voting Rights Act, Your Honor, but certainly the legislative history didn't speak to that. It does speak to the existence of a body of expertise and uniformity that is sought by channeling all of these decisions through the Attorney General or the District Court in the District of Columbia. But for the life of me, I don't see that the Attorney General or the District Court in the District of Columbia, no disparagement intended, has any greater expertise in a case of this type where a local federal district court has already considered in great detail in an adversary proceeding the various factors which would affect the formulation of a new plan. And finally, it seems to me that the Voting Rights Act does not contemplate the existence of a pending suit which already raises constitutional issues with which the local federal court has grappled. And that is perhaps a different facet of the suggestion that where you do have a federal presence already involved in the lawsuit, there is no occasion to seek further federal presence in the form of the Attorney General or a district court in the District of Columbia. The decision, we think, of the Fifth Circuit ignores completely this court's decision in East Carroll Parish School Board versus Marshall, in which, in a virtually identical situation, the question was raised in an amicus curiae brief by the United States, and in which this court said that Section 5 preclearance was not required in the case of a plan which was prepared at the instance of a federal district court and submitted to a federal district court. I would like to point out that I see more problems with requiring preclearance of a plan conceived in the course of existing district court litigation than I do in not requiring preclearance. First of these, of course, is the tremendous delay and expense incident to preclearance procedure when you already have a pending lawsuit in a local district court. As I understand those cases in which the question might be raised, and as I understand the Voting Rights Act, if the trial court were required in this case to remand the county to the Attorney General of the District Court of Columbia, the county could go to the Attorney General and proceed back and forth until a plan had been approved there or disapproved. It could then, if it were disapproved, it could go to the district court in the District of Columbia. I assume an appeal could follow that. And then the case could go back to the trial court where, by the express terms of the Voting Rights Act, the question of constitutionality could be litigated. And if the trial court should determine at that point that the plan was unconstitutional, although it didn't violate the provisions of the Voting Rights Act, we would start, I gather, all over on this procedure. And I think that I think that defeats the equitable jurisdiction of the court, and I think it ensures a multiplicity of litigation and perhaps harm to the voters themselves. I can conceive that a political subdivision which did not wish to get right on with a new plan could perpetuate its own unconstitutionally elected officials in office indeterminately by playing the game of proceeding to the Attorney General, of submitting half-hearted plans and so forth. And I realize the answer to that is, well, the trial court could prepare his own plan and order it into effect. But it seems to me that that at that point we would come back to the question then of why it should be that a district court plan is not subject to Section 5 preclearance, why the district court has sufficient ability and expertise to prepare its own plan, but not to review a plan prepared or submitted by a local political subdivision. We think that everything about the Voting Rights Act and everything that relates to the question of preclearance is directed toward voluntarily undertaken changes in voting procedures and not to one which is taking place under the scrutiny of a federal court. Thank you.
Mr. Parmley,
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, before addressing the defendant's arguments, I'd like to elaborate a little on some of the judicial decisions and actions in this case. On October 2, 1979, approximately one year after the trial on the merits, the district court found that Clayburgh County was malapportioned. In the October 2 order, the district court informed the defendants that the initial burden of fashioning a constitutionally acceptable remedy was on the commissioner's court. The district court, quoting Wise, then advised the defendants that it would afford them a reasonable opportunity to meet constitutional requirements by adopting a substitute measure. And if the commissioner's court was unwilling or unable to present the court with a substitute plan, then it would become the unwelcomed obligation of the district court to devise its own plan. The district court then directed the commissioner's court to come up with a plan, and that a hearing was set on that plan on December 10, 1979, approximately 2 months later.
Mr. Powell, do you think that Wise contemplated when it spoke of the unwelcome responsibility of federal courts and the legislative responsibility to comply with the one-man, one-vote rule, that it contemplated an action by a commissioner's court such as this that was forbidden by state law, if in fact it was forbidden?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the commissioner's court action in this case was forbidden by state law.
Suppose it was, then answer Justice Rehnquist's question.
Whether or not Wise would have I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, suppose the state statute forbade county court from doing what the district court asked it to do. Do you think that the district court nonetheless should have required it to do it, or should it simply have devised a plan of its own, realizing that the county court was prohibited by state statute from itself acting at that particular time?
I think if the district court was aware that the legislative body had presented a plan that it did not have legislative authority to present, that the district court should have instructed that legislative body to go back and respond to its duty to present a valid substitute.
As a party to the lawsuit, but not as a legislative body, wouldn't that be? I mean, as a legislative body, it's, bound by Texas law. But as a party to the lawsuit, it's bound by the orders of the district court.
Well, I guess it's just a question of whether or not the district court can defer twice to the legislative body. If it's only given one shot, then I would say if it came forward with a plan that that was invalid under state law, then I would say its second plan would not be afforded legislative deference, and it would be considered as any other plan presented by a party to the lawsuit.
This is a pretty important question in view of the decennial census, isn't it? Because presumably a lot of states and municipal subdivisions are going to be subject to suit if they don't redistrict themselves on the basis of new population figures. And yet, if the district court in which the suit is brought finds that they are malapportioned, and directs them to submit a plan, they may be under some state law restraint as to whether or not they can do the particular thing the district court wants.
Yes, sir, I understand that position, but I believe that legislative history will show that a correct application of Section 5 is that whenever when the legislative body has received a judicial deferral to come up and present a substitute plan, when that legislative body has finalized its plan, which incorporates public policy objectives, and is preparing to submit that plan to the district court, it is in effect seeking to administer that plan through incorporation in the court's order. And by seeking to administer that plan by incorporation in the court's order, it falls under the operational language of Section 5, which is whenever a political subdivision seeks to administer a voting change, then that change must be pre-cleared. Our position would be that the legislative body in that particular case, as part of its legislative duty to come forward with a valid plan, would have had to have Section 5 pre-clearance. The issue of whether or not it actually had legislative authority does not matter because the plan could be implemented through a court order. The operational language is to seek to administer. It doesn't necessarily require that they have to enact it.
Well, what if the census shows, the 1980 census figures show that this Clayburgh County Commissioner's Court is malapportioned, and the Commissioner's Court simply sits on its hands and does nothing, so that it can't be accused of seeking to institute any new thing that would be required to preclearance under Section 5. Nonetheless, plaintiffs bring an action in the district court saying you're violating our constitutional rights because it's not one man, one vote. They're kind of between a rock and a hard place, aren't they?
Well, I think that the legislative history of Section 5 supports the application which I just told you, that in 14th Amendment cases where there is a violation that is found by the court, at the 1975 extension hearings, the Senate Judiciary Committee report specifically stated that after the invalidation of a plan by the legislative deferment, the court should defer its consideration of plans presented to it until such times as these plans have been submitted for Section 5 review. Only after such review should the court proceed with any remaining 14th and 15th amendment questions.
What if in this case the Commissioner's Court had said, Judge, we just don't want to come up with a plan. It's too difficult. We don't think we have this authority. And even if we did, we just don't agree with you that the old one is bad. We're going to appeal, meanwhile, if you want to put in your own plan, go ahead. You don't think the judge would have held the Commissioner's Court in contempt, do you? You think the court has authority to order the submission of a new plan? It can give the legislative body time to submit a new plan. You think they can order it and enforce that order?
No, Your Honor. My reading of Wise is that the
well, then what if the Commissioner's Court just sits on its hands, as Justice Rehnquist says, and once the declaratory judgment is issued, it just doesn't do anything. The court then is going to prepare its own plan, isn't it?
Or invite the plaintiffs to submit plans, and that may be an incentive for the legislative body to come
up with
their own plan.
Well, it may be, but if they don't, and the court puts in its own plan, then unless we overrule our cases, the court plan isn't subject to preclearance, is it?
That's correct. If the legislative body does not propose a plan, then that's
not
subject.
So it may be that we're not arguing about much here in the sense that a commissioner's court could just, or any legislative body, after a declaration of unconstitutionality of an old plan is just going, if it doesn't want to pre-clear, it just isn't going to submit a plan. Of course, a lot of legislative bodies would rather have their own plan in than a court's plan, but nevertheless, there is a way of avoiding pre-clearance, apparently.
Well, if he's right, here the district court used the word directed. With that in mind, the defendants are hereby directed to submit a proposed new plan by the 13th day of November, 1979. You think that should be read as requested?
Yes, Your Honor. I said that.
Although it's not the word he used.
Well, he said directed, but he also said he was affording them a reasonable opportunity.
If the defendants didn't comply with the direction, they might be in contempt of court.
But you just suggested that probably the court didn't have power to order anybody to submit a plan, a legislative body to submit a plan.
Well, Well, I think it could order. I think it could order a legislative body to come forward with a plan.
And here it seems to have done so by use of the word direction, directed. Didn't say requested.
Mr. Palmer,
or given an opportunity to.
Could it be that whether you use requested, directed, or suggested, what it means is if you don't prepare one, I will.
That's my understanding.
Well,
they're giving them an opportunity.
Could not the legislative body frustrate even the most mandatory direction by submitting a plan that was on its face unacceptable and then put the court in the position of having to do its own plan?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would say that there would be an incentive not to do that because the court may adopt the plaintiff's plan, and I don't think a legislative body would want to have the plaintiff's plan adopted. But
here, did the plaintiffs submit a plan?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. It was submitted at the trial on the merits, and I might add that that plan did not split election precincts.
Of course, the part of the plaintiff's case was a dilution of the votes of Mexican-American voters, a claim that was rejected by the district court.
Yes, sir, that's
correct?
True.
And did the plaintiff's plan meet the plaintiff's theory in that regard, that it diluted the votes of Mexican-American voters?
No, in our opinion, the plaintiff's plan tried to correct that.
Yes. Well, that claim was rejected by the district court.
Well, the district court found there was no dilution of Mexican-American voting strength.
But that there was a violation of the one-person, one-vote principle.
That is correct.
Right.
Maybe I missed something, but what would be the constitutional objection to a district court ordering a party to a lawsuit who's found to have violated the law from proposing a remedy? I don't understand why there'd be any constitutional objection to such an order.
Well, I believe they could. I think that's what, in fact, happened in Burns v. Richardson. I think the court there ordered them to come up with an interim plan, and they, in fact, did. So I guess the answer to that is yes, they can order them to come up with a legislative plan.
That is, order them at the pain of contempt, or order them, and if they don't do so, then the court does its own.
Well, I guess they could put them in contempt. If they don't follow an order, it seems to me that the
you mean an entire state legislature is in Burns?
Well, that's an issue we don't have directly.
Yeah.
Well, what happens to the county in the meantime? How is it governed? If the statute it had was bad, or the ordinance it had was bad, and the court is not satisfied with the plan proposed by the defendants, it's unwilling to adopt the plaintiff's plan, doesn't it have to simply impose a plan of its own?
Yes, I think it would impose probably an interim plan and possibly request the defendants to come back with a satisfactory plan, request the legislative body to come back once again.
Under our cases, it wouldn't necessarily be reversible error if, pending a new plan, the old plan stayed. Even the unconstitutional one, we've sustained that.
Yes, that's correct. I think the district court could do that under its power. In relation to the legislative authority of the Commissioner's Court to redistrict, there is an authority that I left out in my brief that I would like to bring to the attention of the court, and that is an opinion from the Texas Attorney General. That opinion is opinion number M606, and the facts of that case are that Bailey County, Texas, redistricted their Commissioner Court precinct lines in January of 1970. And in the process of redistricting their commissioner court precinct lines, they split election precincts. Bailey County then sent a letter to the Attorney General and said, now that we've split election precincts, can we conform those election precincts with the commissioner court precincts? And the Attorney General responded and said, yeah, I understand your situation. You did split the election precincts. That's fine, but you cannot now conform them. You have to wait until the July or August term of court. I have a copy of that opinion here today if the court would like me to leave it. Additionally, in that case, the Attorney General cited the various articles of the Texas Election Code and the Texas Constitution that have been argued back and forth here today. The Attorney General also cited the case of Wilson v. Weller, which the petitioners depend on for their support that they did not have legislative authority. I might add that in the case of Wilson v. Weller, that involved a single unitary order of Clayburgh County that involved the same county, where they redistricted commissioner court precincts and election precincts at the same time, in the same order. And the court in that case found that they could not redistrict election precincts. Although they could redistrict commissioner court precincts, they could not redistrict election precincts. And they invalidated that part of the order in reference to the redistricting of the election precincts.
Leave the copy of that Attorney General's opinion with the clerk, will you?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Wallace.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Counsel for the petitioners has correctly stated that there was a federal presence to which the commissioner's court submitted their proposal for a reapportionment, but that was wholly apart from who the federal presence was. The district court did not purport to apply the standards of Section 5, did not make any inquiry about whether there was a retrogression in the treatment of minority voters within the meaning of this court's decision in Beer, let alone place the burden of proof on the covered jurisdiction that it would have to sustain under Section 5 proving that the purpose or effect is not to discriminate. The question before the court is really a narrow question of statutory interpretation about the meaning of the words seek to administer in Section 5. It's a question that the court has found recurringly troublesome in trying to interrelate Section 5 with reapportionment litigation. And there is, as Mr. Justice Rehnquist has suggested, a need for as much clarification as possible now with all the reapportionments that will be resulting from the 1980 census. For the interpretation of this language to be consistent with the statutory purpose, it is crucial in our view that two very serious pitfalls be avoided. One is to avoid an interpretation that gives jurisdictions covered by Section 5 a disincentive to reapportion themselves. It's settled by this court's decisions and by the legislative history that Section 5 does apply to reapportionments. And this court has reiterated time and again that reapportionment is principally and ideally a legislative function, and that legislative bodies should be given an opportunity to undertake to do the reapportionment on their own. But it's always easy in these situations for a legislature to do nothing and to hold back, as was the case of the commissioner's court here until 8 years after the 1970 census. And it's not uncommon in covered jurisdictions for us to encounter this kind of holding back, even under the 1970 census, particularly if there's hope that thereby a reapportionment will eventually be achieved after someone brings a lawsuit without a necessity to submit the legislature's proposal for Section 5 preclearance. And if the covered jurisdiction can avoid submitting the proposal that way and still propose it to the reapportionment court under an entitlement to deference from that court under this court's decision in Wise against Lipscomb, the deference that would be afforded to a legislative proposal, then the way is open, it seems to us, to widespread evasion of this court's decision in Georgia against the United States that the protections of Section 5 are going to be available for reapportionments, and the congressional purpose that's been strongly stated in the legislative history in the reenactments of Section 5, that reapportionments provide a special danger to minority voting rights, and it's important that the protections be afforded. Now, this brings me to the second interrelated pitfall that it's very important to avoid, and that is creation of a gap or a loophole in the protection afforded by one or the other of two lines of decisions of this court. And one of those lines of decisions holds that efforts by covered jurisdictions to reapportion themselves must be pre-cleared, even if those efforts occur in the course of reapportionment or other voting rights litigation. That is Connor against Waller and related writings in other cases. And the second line of decisions is that judicially imposed reapportionments need not be pre-cleared, but they are subject to special remedial standards, and those standards are protective of minority voting rights in application, even though they're not identical to Section 5. And our principal submission is that the standards for what is a legislative plan and what is a court-imposed plan should be the same for purposes of both of these lines of decisions. The court's opinions have assumed that the standard is the same for both purposes.
The substantive standards are a little different when you come to multi-member districts and so on.
That's right. The substantive standards are the same, but in defining what is a court-ordered plan and what is a legislative plan, as we've set out on pages 28 and 29 of our brief, opinions of this court have assumed that you arrive at the same answer for both purposes, and Congress has certainly operated on the assumption that there is not going to be a gap in protection whereby in a covered jurisdiction a reapportionment can occur without either protection being afforded to minority voting rights. And so our proposed solution, the interpretation that we espouse and that Mr. Parmley was espousing, is one that we have proposed to the court before. But happily, it's one that is consistent as we see it with the statutory language and with the legislative history, to the extent that legislative history specifically addresses this question, and it does in the 1975 Senate report. And that is that seeks to administer does embrace a proposal by the covered jurisdiction to a reapportionment court, that court order into effect the reapportionment plan that the covered jurisdiction is in the course of litigation proposing. We don't think that this really should turn on niceties of state law about whether there is some limitation in the authority of the covered jurisdiction's body making the proposal to have enacted this change on its own in the absence of the reapportionment litigation. This would raise many uncertainties about the coverage and difficult questions of state law to be resolved in federal courts, which have no particular expertise about them. But the result either way would be that the covered jurisdiction would be seeking, through the approval of the reapportionment court, to administer a new apportionment, precisely
well,
what
Wallace,
Congress
what
said
if,
that it should be protected
if,
event.
What if the commissioner's court said that, Judge, we just aren't able to come up with a plan, and we know you, we disagree with you about our old one, and we're going to appeal, but meanwhile, we can't get together on a plan and don't propose to submit one.
Well, then,
and then the court gets Dr. Nash and or Professor Nash and
The court
and
would
the
act
plaintiffs, he puts in a plan of his own.
It would act with whatever other assistance can be made available. The plaintiffs proposed two plans here, and Dr. Nash or other experts might have been available, and a court-ordered plan would then have to comply with the special remedial standards that this court has prescribed for court-ordered
plans. If a county or a state party to the lawsuit actually responds, you think that's any kind of a response is subject to preclearance?
Well, we don't quite say any kind of a response. But
well, I mean, any response, any response that purports to respond to the request or propose a plan.
That proposes a plan. A proposal of a covered jurisdiction to the reapportionment court that this is what we would like to put into effect as our new apportionment raises the problem that Congress was applying Section 5 to assure protection.
Well, you don't think that the responding legislative body has to purport to act legislatively in the sense that it should have a meeting and have a public open to the public and go through the procedures for the adopting of an ordinance? Or of an order or not? Or can I just sit down with this lawyer and say, well, that's all right. Why don't you just go ahead and write this up?
Well, all of that may be much more desirable as a matter of state practice and state law for them to do it in an open way and in the way that they would ordinarily reapportion themselves. But there are many changes that a covered jurisdiction seeks to administer without the enactment of legislation, which have to be pre-cleared. There are many election officials who have authority to change election precincts. There are other steps that are taken and changes in the election law which do not require specific legislation. They're done under a general grant of enabling legislation. And it's not unusual for submissions to be made of changes that the covered jurisdiction is seeking to administer that don't amount to legislation. It's only in this one area that a question has been raised by this Court's opinions about whether something that falls short of legislation is something that the covered jurisdiction is not seeking to administer within the meaning of Section 5.
And Mr. Wallace, what if you run into the situation where the Commissioner's Court, after the census information is distributed, simply sits on its hands and decides it's clear we are malapportioned, but we like it this way, and let someone come after us. Then the plaintiffs come and file a malapportionment suit in the district court. What are the mechanics of your plan as that would proceed?
Well, if the jurisdiction does not respond to the district court's invitation to them to submit a proposal that the district court should put into effect on an interim basis, hopefully, until there's actual legislation enacted, if the covered jurisdiction does not respond to that, then the district court has no choice but to go ahead and remedy the constitutional violation with whatever help it can get from other parties to the litigation.
And that would require no preclearance.
That is correct. We don't see how the language of the statute can be interpreted to say that the covered jurisdiction in that circumstance is seeking to administer a plan. And it's only if the covered jurisdiction enacts or seeks to administer a plan that preclearance is required for what the covered jurisdiction is undertaking to do. It's not the court order that would be precleared. It's supposed to be precleared before the court considers it. And the regulations of the Attorney General do provide for expedited consideration.
Even if a court issues has to draw up its plan and puts it in its decree and orders the next election be held in accordance with this plan, it's the county or the political entity that's going to be conforming to that plan, and it's going to be administering the plan, but it's going to be administering a court's plan.
That is correct, Mr. Justice.
And that is not subject to preclearance, that kind of administering.
I think if they did subsequently have an enactment, replicating the court's plan, that enactment would, under Connor against Waller, have to be submitted.
Yes.
If they felt that they had to do that in order to actually administer the plan. But if they're just doing it under the court's order, our view has been that that is not subject to preclearance. It seems to me that that's the meaning of Connor against Johnson, which
you
says the court's order
that,
is not
Mr.
to
Wallace
be preclearance.
Would you prefer it were not that way?
Well, there's some suggestion in the Senate committee report in 1975 that there would be preclearance even then. And, you know, obviously the full protections of Section 5 might not be available in that situation without preclearance. However, there is considerable protection for minority voting interests in the remedial standards that this court has developed for court-ordered plans. And it perhaps would not be amiss to say in covered jurisdictions, the court in ordering such a plan into effect also should consider whether there would be a retrogressive effect, such as the court spoke of in Beer.
Mr. Wallace, may I ask you a question about the burden imposed by Section 5 on the Attorney General? How many applications for clearance were filed last year?
Well, I'm sure the number is very large, Mr. Justice, but I don't have it at my fingertips.
In the Sheffield case that was here, I think in 1978, it was then indicated that they were coming in at about the rate of 1,000 a year.
I think that's correct.
And that's 4 per business day, approximately. And they must be considered and acted on within 60 days. How much time per application at the rate of 4 per day is the Attorney General able to give to these applications?
Well, there is a considerable staff that works on these matters. Many of the applications are very routine changes that are pre-cleared without much problem, and about 99% of them are pre-cleared. However, that's not true of apportionments.
And a good many of the applications involve multiple changes.
Some of them do.
And the Act requires the Attorney General to exercise his personal discretion.
He has, for the most part, delegated that authority to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights.
At the rate of 4 a day, and a district court judge presumably spends a good deal more time on a question of this kind than the AG could.
He certainly does, Mr. Justice, but as I pointed out at the outset, he is not applying the same standards. He's not making the same inquiry at all. Even though he's spending more time, nobody has made the inquiry if that's the only inquiry made. The inquiry that Section 5 was designed to have made about whether there's a retrogressive effect on minority voting rights.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Hall? You have 1 minute left.
I'll speak quickly, Your Honor. If there were ever a disincentive to reapportionment, it seems to me that the scheme proposed by the respondents would provide that disincentive. Why on earth would a county submit a plan to a district court for approval? Why would it give the district court any assistance at all if it knew that if it were lucky enough to submit a good plan, one that he accepted, it was then going to be sent off to the Attorney General, to the District of Columbia perhaps, and then come back for a subsequent challenge on constitutionality by anyone who wanted to make it, when the opposite choice would be to submit no plan at all, or perhaps submit one that was very artfully deficient that perhaps even the local federal judge could perceive the shortcoming in, let him make the correction, and then it's his plan and you don't have to worry about it. I think this proposal that the United States makes would just compound the problems of our federal courts and our political subdivisions.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...